Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
This week's episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobook titles and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at audible.com/acastofkings. That's audible.com/acastofkings. And Joanna, I think we have some recommendations today, right? We'll do that during the show, but I think you got a recommendation, right?
I do, yeah.
As do I. We both have recommendations, so you better listen to the show to hear what audiobooks you'll recommend. Thanks to Audible for sponsoring us. Go to audible.com/acastofkings to get a free audiobook download. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
And together we're watching season one of Game of Thrones and reading George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones from A Song of Ice and Fire. You can find more episodes of this podcast at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. Also, if you want to comment on our episodes, find us on Facebook at facebook.com/acastofkings. This week we'll be discussing Season 1, Episode 7, You Win or You Die. This episode was directed by Daniel Minahan, written by Benioff and Weiss. For those who are just tuning in for the first time, for some reason, I don't know why that would happen, you join us midstream, but we will be spoiling everything through the show, Game of Thrones, but nothing from future books or anything that's not in the show. We'll also be spoiling everything in the books. We'll be spoiling everything in book one of Game of Thrones up through this chapter. And this week, I think, what did we go through? Daenerys chapter...
Six.
Daenerys chapter 6. So everything through Daenerys chapter 6 is going to be spoiled in this podcast episode. So let's get right into the show, Joanna Robinson. Before we do that, though, we want to respond to... there's one email that we want to respond to. This email came in from Isaac from New York. And Isaac writes in, loving the season one read-along episodes. I'm currently on episode 3. I'm just curious the format that David is reading the book in. Is it a physical book, Kindle, tablet, book plus audiobook combo, only audiobook? I've read Game of Thrones twice, so I downloaded the audiobook for this go-around, but Game of Thrones is so detailed, I miss a lot unless I'm focusing 100% on it. Also just curious on what Dave thinks of Martin's writing style. Does he find it bloated, descriptive, etc.? Well, let's ask you, Joanna, how are you reading the book?
Mostly in my paperback, but I have been supplementing with the audio because I own the audio. So occasionally if I'm driving somewhere or doing chores, I'll listen. And I agree, it's not a good format for your first go through the audio. I think it's easy to sort of lose focus on the minute details. So I would read print if this is your first time. But if you're going back through, the audio is kind of fun. So
For me, it is Kindle. I'm going through it on a Kindle, and I haven't found much success mixing audio and book or Kindle yet. I know some people do that, but it feels like a violation to me. it feels like an unholy marriage. No, I'm just joking. It is a cool feature that Audible has where you can read along the book and then like pick up right there in the audiobook. That's not for me yet. I kind of stick with one format or the other. But yeah, as for George R. R. Martin's writing style, overall, I find it quite enjoyable. I think the dialogue is great. Much of it is taken on the show. I think the only thing I am not a huge fan of is just, as we've talked about, all this extensive world-building elements. You know, characters who I know are not going to be important in the show. I just have a difficult time investing in them in the book, do you know? Mm-hmm. And also just like vast descriptions of all the stuff that came before the book actually happened. Difficult for me to really get into. But other than that, I find it very readable. And as I mentioned, I haven't read any fiction books in years. So this is my first fiction book in quite a while. And I'm really enjoying it. So
it's funny. We'll talk a little bit more about in the Audible section, we'll talk a little bit more about another great book with world building. So stay tuned for that. But I will say that I have watched the first couple, no spoilers for this, but I've watched the first couple episodes of AMC's new series, Into the Badlands, which is obviously trying very hard to be Walking Dead meets Game of Thrones. Like, it's very clear that they sort of crafted this in a lab to try to hit like the most popular demographics. And so they've got this world, but it really, like, you know, it's creative and the fight scenes are amazing and all sort of stuff, but it's just kind of hollow because it doesn't have that huge heft of world building that George R. R. Martin has. And like, as boring as those details can be to read sometimes, just the knowledge of how incredibly rich his fictional world and like Tolkien's fictional worlds are, the fact that entire languages have been created for, you know, these worlds and that sort of stuff, I really think lends a weight to the story that you don't even if you don't even read the books and know that they're there, like, there's something about it that's irreplaceable, that when you just try to slap together a world without those like decades of building, it doesn't work quite as well.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that just continues to blow my mind is how before the show came out, you know, all these worlds were just in readers' minds and imaginations. I know that's a very simple observation, but just this idea that now we have a way of imagining it, and now it's like a pop culture phenomenon. But before that, it was really just all you could think up in your head, you know?
Well, and then you've got like the diehard – like, I think I've said this on the podcast before, but like years ago, I was at a costume party where two friends of mine who are husband and wife were dressed as Cersei and Jaime Lannister. And nobody at the party had like read Game of Thrones or like knew that this was a hilarious joke, like a hilarious incest joke that they were playing on this. But it was like proprietary to these book fans. Like, they were like, this is our world. And now everyone knows Game of Thrones. I know that there are some book fans who are like sad that the whole world now has access to this world when they, like, it was theirs for years. Do you know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean. So, and are you one of those book fans, Joanna Robinson?
No, my book love does not go back far enough. I don't have that cred.
You're not one of the "I was into this before it was cool" book fans.
Right. But I wish I could turn back time and, like, really appreciate that Jaime and Cersei Lannister couple costume that happened.
I guess how – without even – it's – my mind is, like, breaking right now because I don't even understand how people – I guess, you know, George R. R. Martin describes Jaime and Cersei in the books. But you could probably read that description and come up with, you know, 30 different costumes for what they would look like, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, they didn't look anything like – show Jaime or show Cersei.
Right.
But, you know, they still looked like you know, Westerosi characters.
Hmm. What an obscure reference. my big question...
The books were very popular before the show came out.
My big question is, did your friend have an amazing Cersei wig, as Cersei has in this episode?
This is one of her best.
This is one of her throne room wigs.
Like complete with like a little mini crown just sort of shoved in there.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. All right. Well, anyway, let's get into this week's episode. Season 1, Episode 7, You Win or You Die. This week's episode begins in the Lannister camp. The first time we meet Tywin Lannister, the first time we see the extent of the Lannisters, I guess, military forces.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an incredibly memorable scene. We meet Tywin for the first time. He is lecturing Jaime, and he is butchering a stag at the same time that he's doing it.
It's not the most subtle symbol that Game of Thrones has ever had, but
let me ask you this question. What do you think is the symbolism there? Like, what do you make of what the show is trying to say with him butchering this thing?
Well, I mean, Robert gets gored in this episode, right? And his house sigil is a stag. So, you know, it's a Lannister sort of just shoving a knife over and over again into a stag, into a Baratheon.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. I guess in addition to that, on the nose symbolism, I also like that this is a guy who knows how to get, you know, down and dirty and do his own wet work. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I posted this screenshot because I was watching this morning and just so in love with this scene. I love it so much. And I posted a screenshot of Charles Dance butchering that deer on Twitter and asked the question, like, is this the best TV character introduction of all time? And just so you know right away who Tywin Lannister is. It's so good. I got some great responses of alternatives, but
including the Ollie introduction.
Yes, including the Ollie introduction. But like Omar on the wire or President Bartlett, like there were some good options. But I think maybe Tywin Lannister is my favorite. And but someone did bring up, like, I don't think Tywin Lannister is the kind of person to butcher his own deer. But I agree with you. I think maybe Tywin Lannister occasionally is like, you know what? I'm gonna skin this deer myself just because I like to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that also came to mind. The first time I saw this episode, I thought that was an amazing scene. But then upon reflection, I thought, hey, wouldn't he have someone to do this for him? This guy, after all, this guy is apparently really rich, right? You know?
Rich as a Lannister, yeah.
Exactly. So interesting that he would choose to prepare his food himself. Anyway, this is a complete show invention, right?
Yeah.
Probably one of the best show inventions.
I think it's the best. I'm going to go out there and say it's the best show invention.
Second only to Ross, perhaps.
And then Ollie.
And Ollie, yeah. I mean, you're missing the obvious ones, and that's okay. You know, because those go without saying.
Okay. What was I going to say? Yeah, Jaime and Tywin are not point of view characters in the book. So there's no option for this scene in the book, right? The only way we get insight into Jaime and Tywin in this scenario is later when Tyrion joins the camp, right? So, because he's a point of view character. So this is, this is a show invention. And we've been talking about this over the last couple weeks about the scenes in season one, the two-hander scenes that they inserted for running time purposes. Someone just today asked me to remind them what that link was. So it's over on io9.com, and it's the deleted scenes and last minute changes in the first two seasons of Game of Thrones. And this is one of them. Like, I can't believe that there's a world where this Tywin and Jaime scene did not exist. And it's a two-hander inside scene that they could shoot. All they needed to do was get like a prop deer. And then that's all they needed. And it's amazing. Really amazing.
Agreed. And what is conveyed during this scene? Tywin, you know, Jaime conveys to Tywin that Ned is hunting you, and Tywin gives Jaime a very difficult time on a variety of fronts. And you really grasp the relationship between the two. Like, you know how wisecracking and irreverent Jaime is, and within, you know, moments of seeing them, the two of them interact, you understand how he got to be that way.
Yeah. Right?
It just, it all makes sense. You know, when you see someone like this and then it all just kind of locks into place for you, like, oh, I get why Jaime turned out this way. It's because he had this guy as a father.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Your mother's dead. Before long, I'll be dead. And you. And your brother. And your sister. And all of her children. all of us dead, all of us rotting in the ground. It's the family name that lives on. It's all that lives on. Not your personal glory, not your honor, but family.
Do you understand?
Tywin talks a lot about the Lannister family reputation. He's like, we'll all die. I'll die. You'll die. The kids will die. Everyone's going to die. But the Lannister family name lives on. And I think this is something you and I talked a lot about in season 5 of like what happens to the Lannister family name without Tywin holding it all down. He talks about respect. Like every day that Tyrion is in Catelyn's custody, the Lannister name loses some value. And I really think we saw that in season 5. Without Tywin there as this fearsome force, the Lannisters are not as feared. Cersei's position is not as strong because her father was really the one steering the reputation of this family.
Right, and it certainly weakened even more after what the High Sparrow did
right.
to her.
Yes.
But
the High Sparrow never could have touched Cersei like that if Tywin had been alive, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Well, I don't think Tywin would have allowed her to make the
grave
miscalculations that she made.
That's true.
But, also Tywin – firstly, I found it kind of hilarious that he just finished butchering the stag and then wiped his hands and put his hand on Tywin's face. And I was like
– Oh, on Jaime's face?
On Jaime's face, I should say, yeah. Mm. And I was like, that's probably
smells
pretty
of,
ripe.
Smells of Syrah.
But also – Tywin makes this remark about how the future of their family will be determined in the next few months. And I kind of wonder, you know, how much he knows, you know, about what's going on at King's Landing and how much he's engineering on that front.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. Because he was very right about that.
Yes. Right? The last thing I'll say about the behind the scenes of this scene, I think, is that according to this IO9 article, or I think director Daniel Minahan, when the producer saw this scene, they decided Charles Dance needed more screen time. And I think we're all grateful for that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Then we have this scene between Cersei and Ned in King's Landing where it all comes out. Everything that Ned has been researching, the title of the show, all comes down to this scene.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you make of this scene, Joanna Robinson? I thought it was a pretty faithful representation of what happened in the book.
Yeah. I just think it's really crazy whenever you hear one of those really, really memorable Game of Thrones lines, like Cersei saying, when you play the Game of Thrones, you either win or you die. And it's become so ingrained in our pop culture. To watch the genesis of it is really crazy. I really liked the scene. I thought it was a really good condensation of is that a word, condensation? I know it's what you call dew. they condensed the book scene very, very nicely. I think Lena Headey is wonderful in the scene. And I was watching – have you been watching the sort of post-show things with Weiss and Benioff?
No, I watch it on iTunes. So yeah.
After this episode, they Weiss pointed out that something to take away from this episode is that Cersei is used to being underestimated because she's a woman. Like, she's not considered a threat. You know, so Ned, and you get this from the book too, Ned considers that he's doing her a favor by saying, leave, take your kids. I'm giving you a chance to leave. And he's just not treating her as much of a credible threat as she is. And then Renly and later Littlefinger, I think, are both trying to get Ned to understand that Cersei is a real threat to him. And he's honorable, but I think he also underestimates her, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, this whole episode is about Ned misreading his own position.
Yeah.
You should have taken the realm for yourself. Jaime told me about the day King's Landing fell. He was sitting in the Iron Throne and you made him give it up. All you needed to do was climb the steps yourself. Such a sad mistake.
I've made many mistakes in my life. But that wasn't one of them.
Oh, but it was. When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
The thing that's fascinating, and we'll return to this, is how in the conventions of a typical show of this kind, you actually think Ned is doing a good job. Like, at least when I first saw this, I thought, oh, yeah, Ned's doing the honorable thing, and he's eventually going to triumph, of course, because that's how these shows go. That was my thought anyway.
Right.
I don't know if you ever believed that. Had you read the book when you watched the season for the first time?
Yeah. So I knew it was going to happen to Ned, but in the books, I think it's even more. I don't know why it would be, but maybe even more of a shock in the books.
I am a huge appreciator of how the book plays with genre conventions and then just completely subverts them. So it'll introduce these elements that you think, oh, this is definitely – A is definitely going to lead to B, and then it will just lead to like D instead.
Well, also the point of view nature really helps with that because you've got Ned's point of view and you don't have Cersei's. So you're like, yeah, all right, Ned's on the right path and he's doing the things and it's great. You're not inside Littlefinger's head. You can infer from like things he says what's going on, but you're firmly inside Ned's head. So you're like along with him. You're like, yep,
of course. He
changed that one word. He's being smart. He's got the city watch. He's got it all under lockdown. And then
I did find one passage from the book to be particularly interesting in this section. In the conversation between her and Ned, I'm going to quote from the book, Cersei lifted her head, defiant. "Your Robert got me with child once," she said, her voice thick with contempt. "My brother found a woman to cleanse me. He never knew. If truth be told, I can scarcely bear for him to touch me, and I have not let him inside me for years. I know other ways to pleasure him when he leaves his horse long enough to stagger into my bedchamber. Whatever we do, the king is usually so drunk that he's forgotten it all by the next morning." So that's largely taken from the show, except for this line about how she impregnated.
She had an abortion, yeah.
Yeah, she had an abortion. And I guess we've talked in the past about how they retconned their boy out of the season. I would just wonder, was it kind of a weird reference to that? You know what I'm saying? What I mean is that the show invented this boy that Cersei and Robert had, right?
Right.
And I didn't know if this was that was a nod to this line in the book or if they're just completely unrelated.
Oh, I feel like they invented this boy and then just realized that it like didn't work. And they're like, I'm sure no one will remember. I'm sure people won't rewatch this show obsessively and like remember every detail.
Do a podcast recapping every single episode. Yeah.
But also this answers a question that I think you posed a couple weeks ago, which was how long have Jaime and Cersei been carrying on? And, you know, Cersei says in the scene, both in the book and the show, I believe that like from childhood, like their relationship stretches back that far. And that she did have a brief moment when she married Robert and he was this like slim, young, beautiful warrior and she married him. And then like their wedding night, he got too drunk and called out Ned's sister's name and then Cersei was done. So basically her affection for Robert lasted the span of her wedding day and then it was done. So,
well, what I like about that scene also is how it paints everything in shades of gray as the show is. You know, when she confronts Ned with this information, Ned doesn't say, well, you should have loved him anyway. You know what I mean? Because he realizes, wow, that's a really difficult situation to be put in. You know what I mean? And so even though there is no black and white, it's just all gray, like they're trying to make the best decisions that they can that will benefit them or, you know, in Ned's case, that will be the most honorable. And it just shows you that, hey, there's no right decisions here. You know,
there's a line that's in the show that I don't remember being in the book where Ned references the bruise on her face and he says, like, has he done that to you before? Basically showing Ned's sympathy for her, right? And saying, like, you know, has Robert beat you before? Like, are you a battered wife? Like, you know, he's not so blind to his friend. Like, you know, he doesn't see Cersei as a full villain, but once again, he's underestimating her, right? He sees her as a victim. To a certain degree. So,
So, what else?
Oh, something we got a comment over on Facebook. I probably should have down who said it, but one of our listeners pointed out when we were talking about the show invented Robert and Cersei scene that you really liked that I didn't love as much, where she was talking about the time in their marriage where they had affection for each other. One of our listeners pointed out that she must already have had her plan in motion to kill him on the hunt and how much, you know, because he leaves for the hunt right after that, right? And so how much knowing that flavors that scene, like looking back at that scene and knowing that she already had her plan, or is that the moment that she decided to kill him, or what, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it certainly imbues that scene with more poignancy if she had already decided to kill him at that point.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Let's move on. Probably one of your favorite scenes, Jenna Robinson.
You know how I just said, like, a show-invented scene that I love? It's the opposite of that.
So there's a scene at Littlefinger's brothel. I don't recall this in the book.
Nope.
And it's a woman going down on Roz, and then Roz is making a lot of noise, and Littlefinger's like, no, you're doing it all wrong. You're doing it all wrong. Here's how you do it. Got to be more subtle. That's basically the main thrust of it. And then while this woman is, I guess, fingering this other woman, he goes into this whole at the most appropriate time, he goes into this story of what happened with him and Catelyn. In the book, we find out this information through Catelyn chapter, I believe.
Yeah.
But in the show, he's just telling it, you know, for no apparent reason.
Well,
for no apparent reason.
This is actually the first time I've watched this scene and appreciated it in any way.
Mm.
And it's that and I feel dumb for not really solidly making this connection before, but, you know, okay, so Littlefinger says to Roz and this other whore, like, people are going to buy these customers, they're not all men, sure. Well, men or women who come in, they're customers.
Let's be sex positive here, Jen.
They're going to buy your services. They know who you are. They know what you are. So you need to make them forget that, and that takes time. You have to go slow. That's the advice he gives. And it's a metaphor, you know, parallel to what he has done to insinuate himself in this place of power. They know who he is. They know he's lowborn, that he, you know, he grew up in a low position, and he's a schemer, and he just has to slowly ingratiate himself into, you know, all these people, including Ned, including Catelyn, including Cersei, all these people. And then he says, I mean, he underlines this in that speech, because he says, I'm not going to fight them and I'm going to fuck them. Like, basically talking about how he's going to get his revenge is by slowly making these people forget that he's a danger to them. And so then they rely on him and they love him, or at least give him the power that he needs to take advantage of them. Right?
Yeah.
And that's what he did to Ned in this very episode.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely foreshadowing that. I guess my main takeaway, everything you said rings true. So I don't doubt it. I don't disagree. But I think for me, the main takeaway is, you know, here's a guy who is in complete control of his faculties and drives. Let's put it that way. I think that is what the scene established to me.
Because he's not at all, like, flustered or turned on by this.
Right, exactly. He's just so beyond, you know, any kind of
human
conventional sexual desire. You know what I mean? That he's describing it all completely mechanically. He has no emotion. You know, there's no he's barely titillated, if at all. You know what I mean? It just he is in complete control of everything that's going on. And most of all, his emotions. You kind of get the sense that when he's describing the story of, you know, him and – well, that's another thing, is also with him and the story he actually tells is with him and Kat and how he
and
was –
And Brandon,
how he was, you know, almost grievously injured and how emasculating that was. And yeah, you get the sense, hey, who is going to do the emasculating now? This guy.
So, well, I mean, I always...
Who's got two thumbs and is doing the emasculating now? This guy. This person.
I always understood that this was a scene that had, like, visual titillation. I mean, this is the most famous example, I think, of the sex position of Game of Thrones, right? So you've got two women to look at while, you know, poor Peter Baelish has to give this drawling speech about how he loved Catelyn and Brandon and Ned and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, and so I always understood that to be, like, a sort of really, really cheap way to get through this speech. But I don't think that I had ever thought about how what we were looking at with what Roz was doing was a parallel for what Littlefinger would do. Even though he, like, straight out says it. I just can't believe I ever missed it. I think I was just so annoyed by it that I refused to see any value in it.
Fair enough. And yeah, it definitely must have taken a lot of concentration to get through that scene. So anyway... we have a scene in Winterfell with Theon and Asha. This is a show invention. It's not in the book because there is no Theon or Asha point of view chapters, at least thus far.
I think there's some Asha stuff, though. I forget. It might have been like a Bran chapter. But I think there is some sense that Asha is in danger of being like sexually molested at Winterfell. Maester Luwin stepping in. I think there's something like that in the book, but not quite like this. This is more like, let's get some more of Theon's backstory in there, right? Like,
well, my favorite line, great exchange,
yeah,
especially if it's a book show invention, is Maester Luwin saying, Maester Luwin saying, "Hey, this is our guest," and he says, "I thought she was our prisoner," and he says, "Are the two mutually exclusive in your opinion?"
Yeah.
referring to his own situation, of course.
Yeah.
Just some more backstory about the Iron Islands and where Theon's from. And back where I'm from, you would have been, you know, murdered. We would have, like, tortured you to death, basically, is what
in this fun, sea-based sort of way, because that's how we do on the Iron Islands.
That's how they do.
Yeah. We also get more from Osha talking about why she was interested in getting south. And sort of this ominous, you know, these creatures from legend weren't gone. They were sleeping. And now they're awake. Sort of talking about the White Walkers and other things.
Yeah. So that's basically all that function that scene serves. And I think it's also probably to make you remember who Asha is. Because if they had just skipped an episode, you know, it might have been easy to forget this character who we met for 30 seconds last episode.
Yeah.
So. And then we have a scene at the Wall.
Yes.
Where Sam talks about how he misses girls because he's not pathetic enough. And then a horse comes in. It's Uncle Benjen's horse, right?
Yeah. I really do. I've said this before, but I really love John and Sam's sex talks. They're really one of my favorite things.
So what happens? Back to King's Landing. Renly talks to Ned about what's going on. Like, what's he says, you know, Robert's...
This is maybe the most economical adaptation. Renly comes up covered in blood, goes, "Ned, King Robert, there was a boar," like walks out. Like, I'm pretty sure that's all he says, you know, to convey, you know, some shit went down on the hunt. So, yeah.
So Robert is dying. He's been gored by a boar and, he's having conversations with all these, you know, Sir Baratheon's there, Renly's there, Joffrey's there. Robert's kind of apologizing to Joffrey. In the show notes, you write, "Joffrey looks legitimately upset, ?" Why do you say that, Jonah?
Because he did, like, it surprised me.
It's surprising to see Joffrey with emotion.
Jack Gleeson looked like he was playing as if Joffrey really, really cared that his dad was dying when, like, I feel like what the show has tried to convey in the past is that Joffrey doesn't really care about his dad at all.
Where do you get that from? I'm just curious. That's never an impression I got.
I feel like, I don't know. I mean, he certainly says it later in later seasons. He like talks shit on Robert. I feel like there's something before this scene though, that makes it seem like Joffrey has just drunk deep from the Lannister Kool-Aid and doesn't really care about his Baratheon side at all.
Well, to quote a character from the Die Hard franchise, or to paraphrase a character from the Die Hard franchise, there's a difference between not liking one's father and not caring if he gets killed by a boar.
That's true. Okay, good point. yeah, anyway, I mean, this is a show invention. Like, Joffrey isn't in the room, I believe, in the book. And so, I don't know, I just thought it was interesting. I mean, Jack Gleeson, I think, is perfect in all things. So he was directed to play Joffrey as being very upset. But then also you see this play of emotion on his face when Robert's like, "Okay, go away. You shouldn't see this part." And Joffrey looks kind of like pissed and frustrated and disappointed to be asked to leave. Like, he wants to be by his father's side as he dies. So... Mm.
I didn't get that part, but yeah, I thought he left rather dutifully. Cersei, obviously very concerned that Ned's going to make good on his promise.
Yes.
And just tell Robert, but Ned sees his friend is suffering and he doesn't want to enhance that suffering, is my guess, right?
Yeah, Weiss called this the peak of Cersei's uncertainty, this moment.
Yeah.
When she leaves Ned alone in the room with Robert and he's got this information on her.
Right.
And that Ned could, if he had chosen to set in motion a chain of events that would destroy the Lannisters. And he chooses not to because he feels like it would be cruel to Robert and he feels like he can get this done anyway.
Right, right.
Yeah.
When as we've seen, Ned's calculations are not, you know, truly sound in most ways. So Anyway, they have a talk, and Robert surrenders the realm over to him and says, hey, you know, you're taking care of things. You're ruling as king until Joffrey comes of age. A few things to point out in the scene. Firstly, I did think that the book did a better job of explaining the extent of Robert's injuries. Like, in the show, it's like, oh, he's got a little, like, cut there on his stomach, right?
No, I feel like you could see inside of him when Ned pulls the sheet back. I feel like you can kind of see some viscera.
In the book, it is far more brutal from what
That's
I recall.
True.
It's just like apparently they got him from like his belly button to his like throat, basically. Ugh. Like it's all jacked up there. So it felt more obvious like how a boar could have gored him. Also thought an interesting, just a weird, you know, you ever see like a difference in the book? Most of the differences between the book and the show feels like completely insignificant to me, or where the show is cutting stuff out to make things more economical. It just makes sense in general, right? Because a lot of dialogue that's cut out of the book. But there was a line when Robert says in the show, I shove this knife right into that boar's brain. And then in the book, it's I shove this knife right into that boar's eye. And I was just like, huh. I wonder why they changed eye to brain. just a completely random alteration that I was just like, some writer must have thought brain sounds better.
Yeah.
Anyway, so a few significant things in this scene, other than the boar to brain or the eye to brain, Robert turning over the control to Ned, Ned not doing anything with the information that he has. And then of course, Ned's calligraphic writing, writing
beautiful.
Down right, like until my rightful heir or my true heir comes of age.
Yeah. Ned's like one, like dishonorable thing he ever did in his entire life. Probably was changed the wording slightly on right. this document.
And in his mind, he's like, well, of course the rightful heir already is of age. It's Stannis, right?
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
Ned's opinion. What is awesome about this scene is, again, how it trades on these conventions. Because here's the thing. In this scene, like, a lot of stuff happens that you think is going to be significant later on that just is completely insignificant, right? This line that he wrote is annulled by the end of the episode, right?
Yeah,
it's completely invalidated. But the way, you know, the close-up the insert close-up shot of him writing it down, you're like, oh my gosh, like, this is the thing that's going to, like, save his ass, you know? This is the thing that – this is, like, Ned's – pivot or whatever that's gonna completely like save the day, and of course it's just ends up being completely meaningless. So,
yes.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on this scene?
Well, then there's the scene like that sort of follows right from it with Barristan and Varys, right?
Yes.
Where you gotta love Varys,
yes.
right? Varys just like so subtly planting the seed in both Barristan and Ned's brain that Lancel is the one who like made sure Robert was like super drunk or maybe more than drunk, and that, you know, if Lancel did it, it was probably Cersei who pulled the strings. Just so slickly
yes.
did he accomplish that.
Well, so, I love the quote. He says, such a dutiful boy, to make certain his grace did not lack for refreshment.
Yeah.
Which is an awesome line.
Yeah.
And delivered very well. But
yeah. Ned says that they should call off the assassination on Daenerys. Or Robert does. He's like, you were right about Daenerys. I was wrong. I mean, and I think the book does a great job showing you sort of Robert's deathbed redemption, right? And the show, it's so, like not quite as poignant, I think. Still poignant, but not quite as poignant as Robert just really admitting that he was a crappy ruler, that like he never really wanted to rule, like all this sort of stuff. So he calls off the assassination attempt on Daenerys, and Varys, you know, basically said those birds have flown, which is like such a great phrase referencing the Beatles and his little birds and actual birds that carry messages. Anyway, but, you know, this goes back to our question that we had earlier of like, what is Varys doing sending an assassin after Daenerys if he wants, you know, if he believes in the Targaryen restoration? And I can't get too far into this because this is like one of those rare like book spoilers that could still be a thing on the show or something like that. But suffice it to say that there is like it might not be that even though Varys wanted the Targaryen restoration, it might not be that he considered Dany as most viable option for that until she had the dragons, that there might have been another plan that he had in place.
Hmm. What would that plan have been?
I can't talk about it.
I see. Okay. All right. Fascinating.
But that's a good point that someone brought up, that like it might not be that at this point Daenerys was his best hope for Targaryen restoration, and then she like busts out some dragons and is like, oh damn. All right. So
yeah, I mean, you know, Ned tried to tell Robert that, hey, you shouldn't be killing children. And I think it's probably more poignant in the book because, you know, I think Daenerys is what, 14?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If Emilia Clarke was 14, well, firstly, that would have been illegal to show, you know, what they showed on the show in Game of Thrones. Yeah. But also, it would have made her murdered far more monstrous, right?
Right.
I think.
Right. Yes.
And, you know, Robert didn't listen. But you know who does listen, Joe Robinson?
Who does listen, Dave?
People who subscribe to audible.com.
All they do is listen.
That's right, because Audible is one of the finest purveyors of audio products on the internet, with over 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word products. And they have some awesome titles and some awesome performances. And if you are a fan of this podcast, of listening to things, you'd probably enjoy audible.com. Go to audible.com/acastofkings. That's audible.com/acastofkings. Support this podcast. Get a free audiobook download. It's a good deal. So today we have a couple recommendations. John Robinson, why don't you start?
Okay, so I can't believe I didn't think of this last time we were talking about this, but okay, so the BBC just announced that they are going to be making a TV series of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials, which was already made into a subpar maybe film called The Golden Compass. That's the name of the first book, depending on where you live. And anyway, so the BBC is making this TV series. It's going to be, I hope, amazing, and everything this book deserves, this trilogy. So I would recommend you get ahead of the curve if you haven't already and listen to the His Dark Materials books by Philip Pullman. And here's why you should listen instead of read. There's a great version that's a full cast recording, so different actors reading every single part, and then the author himself, Philip Pullman, doing the narrating. It's amazing. So go to Audible, look up His Dark Materials, or you can start with just The Golden Compass. Get the version that's a full cast recording with Philip Pullman doing the narration. You will not regret it. When you talk, I promised earlier I would talk about world building. This is incredible, rich world building. I'm not promising that I'm going to do a His Dark Materials book 2 show podcast, but maybe I will. And you'll want to be a smug book listener if we end up doing that. So,
alrighty. Well, that's His Dark Materials. I recommend Aziz Ansari's Modern Romance and Investigation, read by the author. And if you're a fan of Aziz Ansari's comedy, he delves into the perils of dating in the Tinder age. It's rough out there. It's rough out there. and so, you know, it is, you know, interesting to consider that, like, when you go back to Game of Thrones era marriages and how you just, like, women were treated like property and you'd end up marrying someone before you even knew who they were, right? We went from that all the way to now. You can browse through a list of all of these people's characteristics. And, you know, if they don't like The Wire, well, forget about it. I'm not going on a date with them. Do you know what I mean? So it just feels like we've gone completely in the other direction. Modern Romance and Investigation explores topics like this. And it is read very amusingly by Aziz Ansari. So would highly recommend it. And you can find both of these books at audible.com/acastofkings. Get a free audiobook download. Thanks to Audible for sponsoring us, and we hope you will patronize their wares, and we hope they'll be back as a sponsor for next season. So,
you know, I know we're done with the Audible portion, but I do want to say that I'm really interested in reading or listening to Aziz's new book after having watched Master of None, his show on Netflix, which is incredible and does deal with a lot of this like modern dating woes. And it's interesting that you bring up this sort of Game of Thrones marriage thing, because his real father plays his father on the show and tells the real story of his arranged marriage with his mother. So, you know, you get that old world, new world sort of contrast within that show. I've always loved Aziz, but I'm just so interested in what he's doing right now. That book sounds amazing. So.
Yeah, check it out and get it for free at audible.com/acastofkings. So let's dive right back into the episode. We had this scene right before where, you know, Varys says, those birds have flown. And then we get the assassination scene. So I think...
Well, but first we get Daenerys talking to Khal Drogo. She's like braiding his hair and talking about how she wants, you know, to invade Westeros, basically. And he's like, nope, no, we're not going across the sea. We're going to conquer these lands. Why would I want to go to Westeros? There's some cute stuff where she doesn't know the word for land and she teaches him the word for throne. He's calling it a chair. She's like, no, a throne. Like, it's a chair for a king. It's very important.
Right.
You know, but basically he's very adamant that, like, this is not a thing he's going to do.
Right. This actually, was this in the book reading this week? It was, right, this chapter?
Yeah, it's much more condensed, like, in the book. Like, they expanded a bit. But I really like how you see Daenerys's ambition here. Like, how it wasn't just Viserys' ambition to take, to, like, return to Westeros. This is something she very much wants to do. And I think later in the show, we sort of think of Dany's conquering as having to do with, you know, her altruistic breaker of chains, you know, liberating the slaves sort of thing. But before she even got to that, she wanted that throne for herself, right? So, yeah.
So then they go to the marketplace and a few things happen. Jorah gets pardoned by this random kid from presumably from Varys, right?
Right, yeah.
And then Jorah saves Dany's life.
Mm-hmm.
So what was your reaction when you watched the scene?
When I watched it?
Yeah.
I like it. Do you think that you don't understand how Jorah knows that the wine is poison?
No, I think it's... Firstly, I thought the assassin did a very good job. Do you know what I mean? I thought that... I think Jorah basically had his antenna up.
Yeah.
And was
when
looking...
the pardon was put in his hands.
Right.
He was like, oh, shit. If I'm pardoned, that means something's going down.
I guess I felt really bad for the guy, for the assassin, simply because Jorah had an unfair advantage, is what I'm saying. Like, Jorah could very well have ended up being that guy. Do you know what I, is, you know what I mean? Like, he is betraying Daenerys, right, already. And he could have been the guy that tried to assassinate her. And so I just felt, oh, man, that guy got a raw deal because he didn't get a chance to strut his assassin abilities, you know, uncontested. Do you know what I'm saying?
I guess. He was trying to murder a young woman and her baby, though, so I don't feel too bad for him.
Well, you know, chalk it up to the difference between you and me watching the show.
Okay.
But, yes, you're right. You're right. He is trying to kill a woman and her baby, so I guess that does make sense. But I thought he did it. He, like, the assassin did a very good, like, he had a very, smart mouth. I don't know if that's a term for it. Like, he had a response for everything, you know, like, oh, I'm not worthy of the vintage. That's why I'm not drinking. You know, I just thought it was a very well done scene and very tense as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Dothraki guy kind of ropes him in, you just thought, oh my gosh, this guy is completely screwed. You know,
he is toast. Yeah.
So. Anyway, more scenes at the wall where Commander Mormont is saying, you know, hey, you came to us as poor people, as rich people, without names, blah, blah, blah. And now we're gonna assign you to your duties.
Well, this is a great speech
in
the book, and it's basically word for word in the show,
where
they talk about, like, forget what your old house... Right?
Mm-hmm.
Throw out your rules. These are road rules. Like, you know, forget House Tarly, forget House Stark. You are House Night's Watch. This is your new family, you know? And I think that's really important to understand the identity of the Night's Watchmen. So.
Yeah. And John gets assigned to be a steward, which, mm-hmm. you know, on the show, we slowly understand what this is when he says, okay, so I'm going to, like, change this guy's water and his sheets and fetch his stuff, and, you know, he's not happy about it because he's obviously a talented fighter.
Right.
So.
Well, I mean, Maester Aemon's great line where he's like, you know, what do you take me for, servant, or something like that? And Maester Aemon says, we took you for a man of the Night's Watch.
Where A.K.A. someone who does what they're told.
Yeah, right? Suck it up. yeah, so good. We thought about talking about this a couple weeks ago. There's maybe just one chapter from the book that doesn't even get the slightest mention in the show. And that's the fact that Sam never would have been made a Night's Watchman were not for John doing some wheeling and dealing with Maester Aemon. He goes to Maester Aemon and says, like, listen, Sam's never going to, like, make it past basic training unless you take him on as your apprentice. And he's really smart and he reads books and you should take him on. And basically, you know, John, through this backdoor deal with Maester Aemon, gets Sam out of the hell of getting pummeled.
Getting put on the front lines and dying. Right.
Well, not just that. I thought he would die, but also, like, Sam wasn't going to even be made a member of the Night's Watch were it not for that, you know, at that point.
Right.
He was probably going to die in basic training.
Yeah.
That's not an insult to Sam. I'm just saying, like, I think John literally thought Sam was not going to make it out of basic training alive. And so he's like, hey, come on. He is very smart. He has skills that we can use. So snatch him up. And Maester Aemon, to his credit, does. So, yeah.
Any theories on why they didn't include that in the show? My guess is just they didn't feel like they needed it. Like, because then you've had to explain, like, all the mechanics of how to get in the Night's Watch. And you know what I mean? It just would have required more things than it benefited the relationship.
I guess, but it's just one of the funny criticisms, or one of the, you know, most consistent criticisms, I think, of the early seasons is that they didn't make John seem competent enough or impressive enough or, like, leadership material enough. And I think this is just a good indication that, like, he knows how to use resources. He knows how to, you know, make things move, you know, and he gets it done. So I don't know. I think, yeah, of all the things to cut, maybe it's not the worst thing in the world to cut, but what you lose is a little bit of sense of what John is capable of, I guess.
Let's just talk through all the wall stuff right now. So there's a scene where John kind of complains to his cohort about how it's not fair. And then Pip says, you know what's not fair? You know, I was a singer and then now I'm here.
Yeah.
Which is a show invention, I think. But it does a great job of conveying, you know, what, how people ended up here. And it does, like, you know, result in perspective crashing down onto John's head.
Pip talks about being sexually molested. And then, like, right after that, Sam was like, give us a song, Pip. Sam is, like, forever my soulmate. I was just like, he's
in terms of his social adeptness.
No, he just wants, he just wants velvet and kittens and songs. That's all he wants.
So anything else about the scene you want to mention?
Oh, and then Sam's great line of, I always wanted to be a wizard, which is just like, what?
Sorry. Just, wrong franchise, Sam. Wrong franchise.
I don't know if we mentioned, oh, we did, that Benjen's horse came back without him.
Yes, so, we did.
Yeah. Okay.
And then they go out to, you know, at the wall, they go out and say their vows, which is like a really badass vow, right?
Yeah.
And then a hand is carried back to them by John Steirewolf.
Yes.
And that is that. Right.
And it's a nice echo to, like, hear them say those words. And then I think the next time we hear them is when Gren says it right before he dies at the Battle of Castle Black. Like, right before that giant kills him, Gren and his men say the Night's Watch vow. I mean, that's probably not true. Probably a million people are going to write in and talk to me about when else in the show we've heard it. But those are the two most memorable times, I think, that we hear it. So
I just love all the language around the wall. You know, I just think it's great. Like, take the black.
Sword, the light in the darkness.
Right, the light in the darkness. And then, you know, when someone dies and now his watch has ended.
Yeah.
You know, just all that stuff is just, I mean, it will make a lasting impact on popular culture. You know what I mean? I think decades from now, people will still be reciting that stuff. So I think it's all just really well thought out. Very good.
Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers, and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the shield that guards from the realm of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch for this night and all the nights to come.
Oh, there's also this line we should mention about, like, the old gods and the new, right?
Yeah.
So, like, John worships the old gods. Is that right? Then the seven are the new gods, right?
Yeah, and then like Rolor is an even like another thing. The red god is a different thing. But yeah, I like that Sam like decides to go with John, even though his family doesn't worship the old gods.
Right.
And yeah. And also it's funny listening to this, the Storm of Spoilers podcast that I do, the intro music is Sam and John saying the Night's Watch vow over this like techno beat. It's this like great track that, and so like I've heard it a million times set to music. And so just to like hear it on the show again, it's just really funny. Anyway. Yeah.
All right. And then we get to the increasingly poor decisions of Ned Stark. a series of
Ned, you know, Margaret,
much more stupid decisions that result in him getting into a bad situation.
I mean, I don't like calling him stupid. I don't know.
One thing that I think the book does a better job than the show of establishing is why Ned is so loath to separate Cersei from Joffrey, right? In the book and the show, there's this line like, "I will not dishonor Robert's last hours on earth by shedding blood in his halls and dragging frightened children from their beds."
Right.
And there's more explanation in the book of, you know, why he is so averse to harming children.
Yeah.
I think it was because of what happened when they dethroned the Mad King, if I recall correctly, right? But basically, like, his aversion to that is just much better established in the book. As opposed to in the show, he's just, like, an honorable dude.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Cersei, like, goes straight for Ned's children.
Right.
Like, in the book, after Ned is taken, the next chapter is Arya's chapter where she's taken, and then Sansa's chapter where she's taken. And it's just like, you know, Renly's like, "Let's take Joffrey now." And Ned's like, "How horrible. I would never." And Cersei's like, "Whatevs. Let's kidnap his daughters." Yeah. So,
I mean, at this point in the show, like, Robert's still not dead yet, right?
Right.
So this is kind of the point of no return from my perspective. Like, if Ned had done what Renly had said, he might still be alive today, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, if, I mean, it's like,
and even if he had done what Littlefinger had said, he might still be
alive. We talked about what, like, Catelyn, like, if Catelyn had done this, you know, like, if Ned had told Robert by his bedside about this, if Ned had accepted Renly's help and backed Renly, if Ned had done, like, Littlefinger had a whole very complicated scheme about, like, protecting Joffrey, marrying Joffrey to Sansa, like, killing Joffrey eventually, probably. Like Littlefinger had it mapped out. And I wonder, like, was that ever Littlefinger's actual plan? Or did he just present this plan that he knew Ned would never go along with because his endgame was always turning on Ned
right.
in the throne room?
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah. So, you know, this is a turning point for Ned. And he says, "Hey, I'm not going to do this pretty sensible suggestion from Renly." You know,
right.
He is too obsessed with honor and making sure, like, Stannis is you know, the one who gets into power. And the thing is, in the show now, like, in retrospect, we know that Renly is right. Right. That, like, getting Stannis, like, there's no reason why you want to get Stannis into power, you know, or it's not, he's not like a beloved person, right? And it's not necessarily like he'd make a great ruler either.
Right.
So, anyway.
Well, I mean, Renly had this whole question of, like, do you really believe, you know, he's like, "Yeah, Stannis is a good soldier, but do you believe that good soldiers make good kings after having seen what Robert did?" And I think it's an interesting question. Like, what makes a good king? Would Renly have been a great choice for the Iron Throne because he's so, you know, so popular, so political, so basically decent.
Yes.
You know, and I don't know. Like, who do you think of all the, like, characters we've met in the show, who do you think would be the best person to sit on the Iron Throne?
I think Ned would have made a good ruler, but, you know, Robert made the classic mistake, and we saw this in the movie Gladiator as well. Don't surrender the throne to someone without anyone around. You want as many witnesses as possible. Why don't dying people know this?
He had one witness in the book. There were no witnesses in the show, but he had one witness in the book, and I don't think there was any question in the throne room when Cersei rips up the paper that it wasn't legitimate. Right? Barristan's like, "Well, that was the official
king's words."
King. Yeah.
The king's
she's
words.
Like, she's like, "We got a new king now, bro." but I don't know. I think Ned is too honorable. Like, you need a little bit. Like, if Ned had allowed Varys and Littlefinger to, like, do some dirty shit for him, I think you need to be a little dirty. It's like why I think Hillary Clinton will make a good president. Mm. Like, people are like, oh, the Clintons, like, you know, they're dirty. I'm like, well, you know what? I think they probably are a little dirty, but I think you need to be a little dirty to play that game. You need to
be a little dirty.
Right?
Yep.
So, I mean, we don't want anyone as calculating as Littlefinger, but I think we need someone who is willing to do, I mean, Tyrion. That's who I think. Tyrion, who I think is basically good, but is willing to do what needs to be done for the greater good. Right. Like, won't always necessarily do the most honorable, the most straightforward thing, but we'll do the thing for the right outcome. Tyrion of season two, I mean. Tyrion now, I don't know.
So, as you pointed out, Ned has a scene with Littlefinger, and Littlefinger says, here's what you got to do. Make peace with the Lannisters, let go of the imp, have Joffrey marry Sansa, you know, you're all set. And Ned's like, well, aside from the fact that they butchered all my men, and why would I ever do that, you know, Stannis is the rightful heir. And Littlefinger is not happy with this response, because I think he has this great line. He says, well, is there anything I can help you with? Because obviously it's not my wisdom you seek.
Yeah, Littlefinger's basically rolling his eyes really hard. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if Littlefinger like actually would have stuck by Ned if they had gone with the like, put Joffrey on the throne, pull the strings, marry Sansa to him. Like, was that ever actually Littlefinger's plan? I don't know, honestly.
Because it's not – and because okay, so the benefit to Littlefinger in that case is he's like Ned's right-hand man.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Ned is ruler. You know, Littlefinger is Ned's right-hand man, whereas if you bring in Stannis, that's like a completely unknown quantity, right?
Yeah, so. And I love how, like, you know, and he's like, and Stannis is war. This is war, and I don't really want war, you know? And Renly says the same thing, I think, is just like, putting Stannis on the throne is the worst idea. You're going to piss off the Lannisters. Now that you've alienated Renly, you won't have Highgarden. You won't have the Tyrells. Like, that's a losing proposition, you know, but like, you know, if you support Renly, then you have the Tyrells and you can probably beat the Lannisters, you know, or if you,
or
keep
if you just take
there,
Joffrey, right. Yeah.
Make peace with the Lannisters. I love that line that, you know, Ned's like, make peace with the Lannisters. I would never. And Littlefinger says like, we only make peace with our enemies. That's why it's called making peace. Like, dummy.
Ned has several options before him, right?
And he's picking the, like,
he chooses the worst one.
With the least amount of, like, chess pieces behind it, right?
Right.
He's, like, thinking he can buy the City Watch and that'll, like, do against all the Lannisters.
That'll solve it. So then Littlefinger says, okay, well, I'll give you the City Watch and we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
So before we get to the last scene, there is one final scene with the Dothraki, right, where Khal Drogo offers Jorah a horse for saving his wife. And actually in the book, I feel like the horse element is like horses are so sacred in Dothraki society, basically, that you realize like what a massive – you know, gift that is.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In the show, it's just like, oh, okay. Yeah.
A horse.
Fine. in the book, it's, oh my gosh, this is like a huge honor that is being bestowed upon Jorah.
Yeah.
And ditto at Dany's wedding as well.
Yeah.
So, and then Khal Drogo goes on this huge rant about how, again, completely meaningless because we know that he and his child will be dead by the end of the season. Right,
yeah.
She goes on this huge rant about I'm going to take over the world and blah, and it's just like okay, like you know, the first time I watched it, I got really excited. I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy, he's going to do it. The show is setting him up to be the victor here, but nope.
Yeah, but that's the thing is like Daenerys is like, cool, here's my champion. This is how I'm going to get my throne. Is my like enormous husband who is like riled up with bloodlust and screaming about raping the women of Westeros and making their children his slaves, which Dany seems perfectly okay with.
Yes.
Breaker of chains. She's like, this is how I'm going to get my throne. She's got this like very like, yes, triumphant look on her face. But yeah, subverting expectations. It's Daenerys herself who's going to have to do the work to amass power, right?
Yep. So then finally we get this very tense scene in the throne room.
So good.
With, you know, and I remember by excitement the first time watching this because it's like, okay, finally, all the stuff that you're building up to is coming to a head right now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Very exciting stuff. And so they go to the throne room and they have the paper, and Ned hands it over to her, and she just rips it up, and we start to get a whiff of Joffrey's dickishness in the scene where he starts saying,
"Kill them all."
Yeah, I wish to be crowned within a fortnight. You may declare your loyalty now. Kill them all. between all those things, I think we get a sense of the character of Joffrey in the scene. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lord Eddard, when we last spoke, you offered me some counsel. Allow me to return the courtesy. Bend the knee, my lord. Bend the knee and swear loyalty to my son. And we shall allow you to live out your days in the grey waste you call home.
Your son has no claim to the throne.
Liar!
You condemn yourself with your own mouth, Lord Stark. Sir Barristan sees this traitor.
Sir Barristan is a good man, a loyal man. Do him no harm.
You think he stands alone?
Kill him! Kill all of them, I command it!
Commander! Take the Queen and her children into custody. Escort them back to the royal apartments and keep them there, under guard.
Men of the watch!
I want no bloodshed. Tell your men to lay down their swords. No one needs to die.
We also get a scene of Janos Slynt saying, "We stand behind you, Lord Stark," and you know all this big show.
Which makes it that much more satisfying when you think about Jon cutting his head off a couple seasons from now, right?
Right. That was very satisfying. Although, I guess the question that came to my mind is, why didn't they just, you know, kill Ned like in the hallway? You know, I guess they wanted to trap all of his men in the throne room.
No, I think Cersei was giving him, like, really would have.
If he had declared, bend the knee, right? He would have.
Yeah, she would have let him go back to Winterfell with his daughters and just live out his days there. Because that is, like, that's the Tywin move, right? Is, like, don't go to war with the Starks, make peace with the Starks, and get them the fuck out of there. Like, that's, you know, and that's really what Ned wants anyway. Like, Ned just wants to go home. If he had just bent the knee, which he does later, but it's too late. But if he had just, like, bent the knee and taken Arya and Sansa home, the Starks would still be, like, living it up in Winterfell.
Right. The Lannisters, you mean?
Sorry, no, the Starks.
Oh, yeah, the Starks have been living it up in Winterfell. The Lannisters have been living it up in King's Landing.
King's Landing, yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, there's just some great lines in this scene. You know, we'll allow you to live out the rest of your life in that gray waste you call home.
Yes.
And then you condemn yourself with your own mouth, Ned. You know, like that whole thing that Cersei says when, you know, he lays out the facts of the throne succession.
Yes.
It's awesome. It's an awesome scene, and you just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and it would be perfect if not for that abomination on top of Lena Headey's head, that awful throne room wig.
I think it's amazing. But yeah.
Yeah, it's a great scene. It's still, like, even knowing what's coming, it's still just, like, your heart sinks when the City Watch, like, turns their spears on the Stark men.
I would say that I wish there had been like a even more clear way to convey what was actually going on. I mean, you get it pretty quickly, you know what I mean? But it's not as though like, oh, these are the City Watchmen and these are the Stark men. I guess they're dressed a little bit differently. It just happens so fast, you know?
I know, it would be great if there were a little like, because there were also the Lannister men, right? The red cloaks,
right?
The Lannister men. The Stark men are in like dark leather, and then the gold cloaks are the City Watch. But it's, you know, if you're just watching it and you haven't read the books, it might not be easy to tell who all the men are in the room.
The episode ends with Littlefinger taking Ned's dagger out of his sheath and then holding it to his throat and saying, you know, I told you shouldn't have trusted me. So great ending. Great episode. Any closing thoughts, Yana?
I mean, what a fantastic episode. I couldn't remember how far we got in this episode, if we were going to even have that throne room scene. Or if that was in the next episode while I was watching it. And, you know, just the introduction of Tywin alone and, you know, Khal Drogo's big, like, hype moment and all of that and Robert dying was, like, enough to make it a really good episode. And then the fact that it ends with this amazing, you know, such a good scene. Great episode, I think.
This episode moves, man. It's just, like, so much stuff is happening, tense confrontations, and then you understand how Ned is the architect of his own demise.
Yeah, really.
It gives you that information. Great episode. You know, it's awesome. It's I mean, retroactively, I enjoy the head fakes, you know, because I know what they're doing, but because now that I've gone through all the frustration of things like the Red Wedding, I understand kind of what the show is trying to do. But, you know, at the time when season one wrapped up, it did feel a little bit frustrating. You know what I mean? That the his rightful heir. Oh, that's what's going to happen. And then, you know, Ned's dead. And then Danny's kid is dead. You know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
A lot more stuff. We're near the end. We got three more episodes left, but a lot more stuff is going to happen before the end of the season. So, yeah.
But it is interesting that Ned is in captivity for like the next two episodes. And then I think we've got a lot of like some Tyrion stuff to take care of. And I mean, we have to meet Shay, which is everyone's favorite character. So there's a lot to do.
A lot to do. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned to hear where you need to read to for next week. In the meantime, Joanna, where can you find more of your work on the internet?
You can find me over on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can listen to me talk about television in general on the Station Agents podcast or comic books on the Thought Bubble podcast.
Find my directorial debut at theprimaryinstinct.com, where you can buy my film. And follow me on Twitter at Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chensky. Joanna, where are we reading to next week?
We're reading through Daenerys chapter 7, and that is page 674 in my book.
Daenerys chapter 7, page 674. Thanks for tuning in to A Cast of Kings. Find us on facebook.com/A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys next week.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.